Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And welcome to Outcasts with 1988 Kylie Minogue superfan winner David Berry and 1996 Tesco's Bikeathon third regional runner-up Tim Downey. Hello.
Wow.
Today's Outcast will swim with us over the majestic coral reef out into the azure blue waters between the pristine, sun-kissed atolls of Outlanderdom, there to bask like turtles whilst trying not to get eaten by gulls. She's a four-time Golden Globe nominee, winner of two People's Choice Awards, two Saturn Awards, and can also be seen in the brilliant Oscar-winning film Ford and Ferrari. She, of course, has her brownies, rambling, and spearfishing badges, very coveted, very tricky to get hold of, and her 300-meter swim badge, very useful. It's Kat Balf, everyone. Welcome.
Hey, hello.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's
been an absolute
I was never
pleasure.
A brownie. I'm really sad to say I was not that privileged as a child.
That's outrageous. Did you ever indulge in any form of outdoor activity or organized outdoor activity such as
I was raised by wolves, which is why I never went to the brownies.
That will do it. That will definitely do it. Fabulous. How have you been? First of all, how have you been?
Oh my God, I've been amazing. What an amazing 2 months we've had.
I know, hasn't it just? Hasn't it just? I
mean, and the Emmy
I
goes
have
to
lived every
Mouth.
Dream.
It's exactly what I wanted.
It's been lovely, hasn't it?
It's been different. It certainly has.
Although I have to say, I was talking to my sister yesterday, and you know, I think if any group of people have been prepared for this kind of lockdown, it's got to be actors.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know what it's like to have nothing to do, no purpose in life, and just wander aimlessly around our houses for months. So I think I was
exactly, and have
no idea what the future is going to hold.
Exactly. Have no idea whether you're ever going to get paid again, or see the inside of a theatre or anything else like that. Yeah, no, very true.
I think in some ways, you know, I've spent quite a few years of my life preparing for this exact moment.
Excellent. You're match fit for it.
This is your time, Katrina.
Yes, which is shocking because I've absolutely wasted it all. But you know, I should have known better. But I'm not making use of it. So.
Good. I'm very glad to hear that because I've done very little. I haven't done it. I haven't done any of those things that they said, oh, wonderful. With all the time, you can write your script. You can write your opera. I've done none of that. Just basically been homeschooling and walking up and down stairs. A lot of stair walking I've been doing.
A lot of stairs.
A lot of stairs. And on that wonderful link, we here at the Outcast love to replay a scene, revisit a scene as chosen by our lovely guest. And today's scene is from, am I right in saying this is from the first episode?
No.
It was wrong.
It's from the first season. It is episode 109.
That's what I meant. I meant first season. First season, ninth episode.
Yes.
There you go, you see? There we go.
I believe that episode is called The Reckoning. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a fiery and feisty episode. Claire and Jamie go at it, as it were, verbally first and somewhat physically later. But I thought we would pick that lovely scene from the river to have you two recreate it.
Fantastic. And who would you like to play? I mean, you can obviously jump in yourself at any time, but who would you hand out roles to?
Well, I think I'm going to just a little competition between the two of you. The first person to name the two writers from season one who are no longer with us will play the character that I'm going to choose first.
Okay. Ira Bear.
Uh-huh.
Who's the second one? Tim, help me out here.
And Justin Timberlake. Is it Justin Timberlake?
It was Justin Timberlake, wasn't it?
It's not
okay,
Justin
well,
Timberlake.
David was closest, so...
50%. David, 50%.
It was Anne Kenny is the person you're forgetting. David, you're going to play Claire.
Oh, yes! Great, because I do a terrible Jamie.
He really does.
It's not the answer you wanted to hear. It's not because of I wanted to be Claire so much. I mean, I do. I wow. love Claire and all the rest. But Jamie is just, I think we know on this podcast, Tim, I can't do a Scottish accent. And to sustain it for several pages, I think we just should all save ourselves the pain and embarrassment and just go with my Claire. Kat, I'm happy to take notes from you at any point. What I'm doing wrong or
just
right.
Just from the heart, David, just from the heart.
Probably the best note I've ever got.
If it comes from the heart, it can't be wrong.
That's the best note I've ever got. I'm going to go with that.
Fabulous. Right.
And Tim, from
yes.
from the chest, from the muscles.
I'm there. Don't you worry. Close your eyes and you'll be right back in the glens, let me tell you. Right. Are you ready,
Do
David?
I get to say action?
You get to say action.
Not only do you get to say action, you better be reading this big print because we might go a bit astray. Who knows where we'll get at with each other if we don't have you reining us in.
I will pull up that big print then.
Okay. Good. Yes. And Kenny would be very disappointed if you weren't reading it. Was it Ira that wrote this episode?
Let's say yes. I don't know. Was it or was it Matt? You know what? That's terrible. Hey, I can't remember.
It's okay. That wasn't a competition. And look, we settled for 50% for me. So we got it.
Okay.
We got it. Action.
Are you all right? He didn't hurt you.
No, he didn't have the time, thanks to you.
That's settled. He faces her, waiting, but she says nothing. So
I'm waiting for you to see something. Anything that approaches an apology.
She looks at him, not understanding what he wants. He looks at her, exasperated, struggling to keep a lid on his temper.
Oh, right. Yes, I'll do that.
From the heart. Apology? I was taken hostage by Jack Randall. Are you trying to make out that it was my fault?
Jamie's temper builds as he paces in front of her.
Here we go. My audition piece. Here we go. Is it your fault? Had you stayed put where I urged you to stay this morning, this never would have happened. But no, you wouldn't listen to me, and I know better your husband. Why mind me? You're taking it into your mind to do as you're damn please, and next I can, I'll find flat on your back with your skirts of a worst scum in the land between your legs from the point of taking you before my very eyes.
Wow.
The two of them.
Wow. What was that? What was that?
Force of nature. It's like having the wind in the room.
I don't even notice this. You can't have subtitles on a podcast, but we really need them.
Oh, all the intent.
You just said
all
that.
The intent.
Okay. Wow.
Guys, I feel like I need to feel a little bit more anger and passion from both of you. You know?
Okay.
This is the two of them are almost nose to nose. Claire dredges up whatever flaws she can think of. Flaws? I think it's supposed to be. Well, whatever she can think of, and hurls them at Jamie.
I begged you to take me with you. I told you there was no danger in my going, but you would not listen to me. No.
Continued.
Sorry, I'm getting really riled up. I'm only a woman. Why should you pay any attention to what I say? Women are only fit to do as they're told and follow orders.
Now, David.
Yeah.
If it's hysterical, it's historical. How many times has she been told that women have no right? From the bottom of your loins. Go on.
Again? I got to go again?
Yes, I'm giving you notes.
Oh, okay. Wait, that's a really deep note to... Well, can you break that down for a sec? Because I think I got lost at the part. If it's hysterical, it's historical. You got to break that down for me. I'm a bit of a slow
Well,
study.
You've never heard that being said before.
No.
When somebody, like if so in a relationship, right? If somebody does something silly and the other person's response is like absolutely you know, completely irrationally in of a magnitude. It's never about that one moment. It's about the history of 50 moments behind it. So if it's hysterical, it's historical.
Right. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. That's making a lot of sense about the arguments I've had in my past too.
Are we going to lose you now for like 10 minutes where David just flashes?
All the mistakes I've made in my life down to this one acting note. Okay, well, thank you. That we'll press on then.
I just want to feel I'm just a woman. I want to feel your pain of a woman in that one like line. Okay. Come on, David.
Okay. All right. Okay, I'm only a woman. Why should you pay attention to what I say? Women are only fit to do as they're told and follow orders. How's that?
I'm verklempt. Jamie grabs hold of Claire, his hands digging into her arms as his anger takes over.
And if you'd done that, we wouldn't be on the run with 100 redcoats on our tail.
Claire tries to wrench her arms free. Failing at that, she makes a determined effort to kick him in the balls.
Oof.
Ah! Jamie dodges, but lets go of her arms in the process.
Try that again and I'll slap you till your ears ring.
Wow. Mm. Wow. As the actor and the woman here, Kat, I'm feeling something from that line.
Are you getting turned on?
Actually not. I feel like I should be.
Some other emotion.
I feel like I should be. or should I? I'm very confused right now.
David, just allow it. Just allow it, David.
What? The threat of physical violence isn't a turn on, no?
It's so old-fashioned.
I'm trying to step into the shoes of a woman here and understand if it could be. And I'm running up against no, but I'll see where this goes.
She's not. Here's the thing for you. She's not turned on at this point.
Okay.
There you go.
Thank you. I needed to get that.
Just in case.
It's important because I'm acting as a woman here. It's the first time for me. You're a brute and a fool. Do you think I went out and got captured by the English on purpose?
I do think you did it on purpose. To get back at me for what happened in the Glade.
Claire's mouth falls open, incredulous.
In the Glade, with the British deserters.
Jamie nods, sullen. Claire covers, lying about the fact she was actually running towards Craignadoon.
I see. So you thought to punish you, I took a walk in the woods on the chance there might be some British soldiers wandering about. Jamie, all I did was go for a walk.
I ordered you to stay put.
I don't have to do what you say.
Aye, you do. You are my wife.
Maybe some chest beating there, Tim, you know, just to get the real caveman.
That's definitely not a turn on. Am I right here? I don't know.
I think you're right, yes.
You haven't seen me do it yet. I'm not saying it's going to change matters, but, you know. Just, you know, maybe, wait.
I might change my mind if I saw you do that chest beating. You're right.
All right. I'll take the notes, take it on board, and add a little something.
Hey, you do very William Wallace that. Hey, you do. You are my wife.
Your wife. I'm just your property, aren't I? You think I belong to you, and you can't stand to have someone else taking something that belongs to you.
You do belong to me. And you're my wife. Whether you like it or not.
I don't like it. I don't like it one bit. But that doesn't matter either, does it? As long as I'm there to swarm your bed, you don't care. You can care what I think or how I feel. That's all a wife is to you. Something you stick your cock into when you feel the urge.
Jamie loses all colour in his face and he begins to shake Claire in earnest. Her head jerks violently and her teeth clack together.
Let go of me! Let go of me, you fucking bastard!
The insult causes Jamie to fall backwards a step, eyes blazing.
Foul-mouthed bitch. You'll no speak to me that way.
Claire instantly regrets it. But it comes from a place of truth, and they both know it. Jamie takes a long beat to gather himself.
I went to your Fort William Armour, nothing but an empty gun on my bare hands.
Claire's own anger is beginning to fade. Her affection for Jamie blooming again as she watches the young man before her bare his soul. Can we see your soul?
And when you were screaming, I'm going full Daniel Day-Lewis on this.
Yeah.
Tears well up in her eyes. All the rage has completely left Jamie at this point. He takes a long beat, turns away from her, then sits down, propping himself against a fallen timber and lowers his head.
Tim, just give me a minute. I'm going to try and squeeze out a tear here. No, it's not coming. Go.
Okay. You're tearing my guts out, Claire.
Claire, her own guts being torn out as well. Front of him. We missed an in there.
Yeah.
Taking his hands in hers.
Tears coming now, Tim.
Good.
I'm sorry, right. Jamie. Forgive me.
He looks at her now. A beat. Then.
Forgiven, lass. I'm sorry too. I'll ask your pardon for what I said. I was sore and I said more than I meant. Will you forgive me too?
With a bit of shame, Claire responds softly.
Okay, I'm kind of turned on now, maybe? Don't know. What are we supposed to feel here?
Well, I would say probably, I don't know that she feels shame. I probably would have argued against feeling shame at that point. But, you know. These kids
together, messing around in a war. What are you going to do? Well, thank you.
I mean, guys, chills all over.
Hopefully we've given you, I know it's a bit after the horse has bolted and all that, but hopefully it's given you an insight, maybe, that maybe you wouldn't have got before.
Which certainly gave me an insight that I wouldn't have got before. I've played a woman and...
Do you feel changed on a cellular level?
Cellular, no. I still have all my bits, I think. And they're still there.
Although you have taken your jacket off. I don't know if the two things are related.
Getting a bit flushed here for the audience at home. I did take my jacket off. I did feel something. It could just be the frisson. That's what happens in these scenes, frisson. But that's a little bit... something a little bit problematic about this scene too. That threat of, if you're asking me as a woman, that threat of violence, just, I don't know if I can get past it. I don't, how did
it's
you
from
get
from a
past
different
it?
Time, David.
Okay.
And she taught him that, you know, it's not okay ever, but he had to learn. And Jamie does learn. And that's what makes him different from all men of his time, is because he has the emotional intelligence to be able to learn.
That's
and
true.
Be a better human for it.
Well, Kat, I was going to start off by asking, you know, Outlander, as it stands at the moment, is an end point. That's where we are at this precise moment in time. But where I like the journey. The journey is the thing that interests me. So at the moment, you have a book club. So obviously, you have a great love of art, of books, of reading. And was that where you grew up? Were your parents readers? Were they into the arts? Was that sort of where you grew up? Was that your background?
I mean, yes, we are all a family of big readers, but my parents, I grew up very much in the country. There wasn't a huge amount of culture where I grew up. You know, my dad was a police sergeant or a Garda sergeant, and my mom for most of our lives was a stay-at-home mom, but my dad was very involved in a comedy troupe where he and it was, I mean, it's, there should be something made about them. It was basically two school teachers, a farmer, a shop owner, and a police sergeant, and they would write their own skits and perform them and would also be in these competitions, and they won all Ireland championships a couple of years in a row and stuff. So I think the whole acting thing probably came somewhere from him or that. But I also didn't have TV for many years growing up, so the library was featured heavily in my childhood. And we would go every week
and have
get a stack of books. Yeah, my little brother broke it. And
still not going to let him forget that. Still.
Yes. No, so I was watching it. Francis wanted to play and I didn't. And he unplugged it and walked with the plug. He was like three and it fell down and smashed. And my dad was like, right, that's it. No more TV for a few years. Yes.
That sounds really kind of, that's a harsh punishment for a seemingly small infraction there. Was he already against the TV? Was that something he wasn't keen on or?
I don't know. I mean, I think probably we were encouraged not to watch it that often. I think, you know, I grew up in the country and I think we were sort of thrown out of the house and told to go off and play quite a bit. So, childhood was very, very outdoorsy.
Yeah, my childhood was very, very similar. I grew up in the country and my parents, my father went to art school, but are not particularly arty. And so I was very much sort of like the black sheep of the whole village for wanting to kind of like, oh, well, let's look at it, you know, let's look at things in a different way. But it took until I left where I was and went to the city. Was that something very similar to you? As soon as you kind of leave where you are and you kind of go into the melting pot of a city where there are so many differing throngs, is that when it started to begin to go, ah, maybe this is something I'd like to pursue?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, no, I mean, so where I grew up is it's a very small community and definitely I felt a little bit like the outsider there. And you know, obviously it's a border county. I come from a border town growing up in the 80s there as a policeman's daughter. You're a bit like that anyway. I definitely think in going from my tiny primary school, which had 100 people, there was 8 in my year. But when I went to the town, the secondary school, I definitely found like-minded people there. And I was really, you know, any kind of theater group that we had in high school, I was hugely involved in. And I knew at that point that that's what I wanted to go on and do. So I knew as soon as I was going to leave school that I was going to go away somewhere. And so I had applied to a bunch of theater programs and I went to Dublin and was studying drama in Dublin. But weirdly, I didn't love it as much as I thought I would. I mean, I loved the learning part, but I think I was too young. I was 17. It was my first time out of home and I was probably more interested in going to the pub than learning how to do a fencing dance with, there was just certain parts of the program and I'm not a singer and they were trying to make us like singers and dancers It was that kind of drama program and I loved the acting part of it, but my singing teacher said horrible things to me and so I didn't connect with it as much as I should have at that time. And so when at the end of the first year I was given an opportunity to move to Paris, I was like, out.
Lovely. And how long were you in Paris? Did you continue studies in Paris or were you working in Paris?
No, I became a model and I was working in Paris. So I lived in France for 2 years. I lived in Paris for about 18 months and then I actually did a winter season in the French Alps. I sort of took a year out of modeling early on and went and did a winter season and then did a bit of traveling and then went back to it and then I moved to London and then New York.
Very well traveled. And what, with your father being involved in comedy, did you ever think that that would feature far more heavier, like, you know, did you think, oh, maybe comedy would be a route, seeing as you kind of see it with a parent and quite successfully as well?
I mean, it's funny. I don't know. I guess it's like something that's never really come to me. So I've always geared more towards drama, but it's something I secretly would like to, I don't know, try my hand at. I don't know if I'd be any good at it.
I think you would. Put on a fake nose, a wig.
I think people laugh at me a lot, but I mean, unless you've seen Star Force, that wonderful recent.
Oh, you were brilliant in that. You're like that. I said you're like that chick from Austin Powers. What's her name? Ivana Humpalot. Somewhere between that and something in Rocky and Bullwinkle. I wasn't quite sure. It was hilarious. I did love it. You should work on your stand-up too. You could have a Netflix special in no time. Why not? I mean, everyone's doing it.
I mean, I could tell. I could think of a few reasons why not.
Well, I wanted to talk about the modeling life for a second, because you went from successful model to very successful actress, but you're not the first person to do that. There's some of my other favorite actors have gone on that path. Like,
not?
No, you're not. Gee, don't be so shocked. I can think of Charlize Theron, Jennifer Lawrence, Jessica Lange is one of my favorites, to name a few. But
Jennifer Lawrence? Yeah. She started acting when she was like 16. How could she have
started
had a
modeling
successful...
before that? Can you imagine? She did.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Overachiever. Jesus Christ.
You can talk. But I think there's this problem that some people have with accepting models as actors. Like, somehow being a model somehow threatens your credibility. And I'm wondering if this is something that you encountered in your career, and what does modeling mean to you in your career as an actor?
Well, it's really interesting because I still get described as a model actress. And I think of all the actors who had jobs before they were actors, whether they were barmen or waitresses or whatever, and none of them get described as barman actor or waitress actress. And it's really funny because it's almost like at some point it ceased to be a job and it became a personality description.
Yeah, this is idea that you're slashy. You can't be two things at once. And somehow being a model / actor erodes your credibility of being a legitimate actor. And I find that very interesting, particularly someone as you who've been so successful. I mean, you're running Victoria's Secret catwalks and stuff. You're cringing once. Hey, I'll take it. If that wasn't the one time in my life, I would claim it for the rest of my life.
God. Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, look, I think it's also interesting because there are certain parallels between the two worlds, but then I think being a model and being an actor are completely different things. You know, as a model, you have to be so conscious of how you look and the image, right? So everything is being aware of the exterior on a constant level. Whereas I think as an actor, that is the antithesis of acting. If you are concerned about how you look or how your body looks in any given moment, then you're not involved in the emotional truth of a scene. So you can't have any of that kind of external awareness. So I mean, for me, personally, they just feel like two totally, totally different things. But I also understand that there's certain things that I learned through modeling that serve me very well as an actor. I mean, I know where my light is without even thinking about it. I can, you know, when I started, even though I had very little experience, I knew without having to think about it, where the camera is and how that it's sort of like a, you know, it's like a natural sort of thing about positioning yourself. And those things sort of came easy because of my prior career. But, you know, I definitely think you have to prove yourself twice as hard sometimes. I know when I first started on Outlander, we had a different hair and makeup person in the very beginning. And I know she made some derisive comment about me being a model. And I think some people think that because you were a model, you get an easier shot at things, or somehow people give you a chance just because you look a certain way. But as I think any actor who's ever gone through a show or anything, you know that you have to earn your place, and you get there because, you know, they're not going to give it to anyone. I hope. I don't know. It's also, I don't know.
It does erode your confidence, though, when people say that. I mean, not many people know this, but I did have a feature in the Big W catalog one year. I think it was year 2000. People who keep those might spot my face there. But I agree with what you're saying. But I think the qualities that make good models often make really good actors. I think having that confidence in front of the lens and understanding the frame is really important, particularly when I think film, maybe not so much for theater, but film is so much about composition and mise-en-scene. And when you think about like films of like Fellini or even Tom Ford and directors who frequently cast models in their films, and they make amazing films, having those qualities of just knowing how to comport yourself in a frame, I think it lends itself sometimes to excellent acting from the outside in rather than the inside out. And Fellini was someone who looked at stuff mostly from the outside in rather than the inside out. But that's a whole another discussion.
No, but I do think it's interesting because obviously, you know, as an actor, it is important to, you know, there's the emotional expression that carries through your physicality. And I suppose I think I had to unlearn a lot of bad habits coming from modeling, but I do think, you know, like I said, I think there is a certain amount of stuff that I was able to take with me that have served me very well in this business.
Just switching gears for a second and talk about love. One of the things
Le grand l'amour.
See, speaks French as well. Little known fact about Katrina Balfe. She could do the rest of the podcast in French. I'm not even going to attempt. But one of the things I find fascinating about Outlander is the way that it deals with romantic love, and the way that it feels, on the one hand, very relatable, but also very idealized and almost remote on the other. Like, somehow Jamie and Claire are these two like super beings who can somehow solve this mystery of the domestic and the erotic in this relationship that they have. And I think what makes it more remarkable is how they've endured this love affair through like time, space, grandchildren or whatever. And they've almost like the model of the ideal passionate romance, right? And while we strive for that, unfortunately, a lot of us kind of fall short of that ideal. And I'm particularly curious about your take on this because recently you took the plunge yourself and got married. Do you think that Jamie and Claire set unrealistic expectations of what we should expect out of marriage? And what do you think our obsession with Jamie and Claire tells us about our own ideas of love in this modern age?
That's a lot to unpack, David Berry.
Unpack it for us.
You know, yes, of course, it's an aspirational love story, but I do think they're both very flawed, and I think their relationship is very flawed, and I think that's what keeps it relatable and, you know, takes it out of kind of the Disney sort of feel of things. And I think that, you know, there's a reason why so many people have loved this book series for 20 plus years and now love the TV show. And I think that, you know, in the sort of grand dressing of fantasy and the fact that there's time travel and that, you know, it's this metaphysical love, very often their relationship does feel very normal and they get frustrated with each other. They make mistakes. I mean, that scene that we just read, you know, you have two people who are coming from very different points of view and are very stubborn and quite stuck in their points of view, but they are able to break down that kind of barrier of stubbornness and you know, instead of just entrenching themselves further in each other's point of view, they learn from each other. And I think that that's, you know, I think that that's a good a good example for everyone's relationship. And I don't know. I mean, I think every TV show and every film sets an unrealistic example for relationships. You know, it's like Sam and I joke all the time with Jamie and Claire. It's like they're the most codependent people. It's like they're about to go to the toilet and they're like, if I don't see you again, you know, I'll, you know, never stop loving you. It's like, right, we're just going to the bathroom. It's fine. I'll be back in 5 minutes, right. You know. And but I also think that, why would we tune in otherwise? You know, we all live sort of lives that vacillate between mundane and something else. I don't know. But, you know, we want to be entertained and we want to see these big emotions played out. And I think it gives us all some kind of cathartic experience. And, you know, as we know, there are many Outlander children out there that people love to come up and tell us about, that, you know, this show has reinvigorated their love lives or whatever it is. And that's kind of amazing to be part of something that, you know.
Absolutely. Although I would love
the fire.
Although I would love to see a scene where Jamie comes into a room and Claire is, you know, sat reading and Jamie will say, who ate all this hummus? who ate my hummus? Because I had a tub in there and there's only you and me here. So who had all this hummus? Or those kind of things. That's marriage right there. Who ate all this hummus?
Sam and I tried to put some funny things in. Like, he has decided that Claire is a terrible cook. So every time we do any scenes where I hand food, he tries to make these little grimaces. So it's like a running joke we have, and I don't know if it ever actually makes it into the cut, but yeah, that's a bit more honest. And why does nobody ever go to the bathroom on TV? Well, like, you never see that happen. I mean, not that we want to, but it's like, you know,
just for thinking time as well, just for kind of, oh god, okay, the English are coming, right, I'm just gonna go to the bathroom. Don't be in there an hour again, because that last time is ridiculous.
Oh my goodness.
We'd all like to see that.
Yeah, I mean, see, there you go, you unpacked it. I'm throwing you all the complex questions, because I think it is a complex thing. Almost kind of disagree with what you say about Outlander, and it's the way that
I was coming on here to be disagreed with. No.
We're not just here to tell you how wonderful you are, because you are wonderful. But I think what's special about Outlander is it does what a lot of dramas don't do. A lot of dramas want to show conflict within relationships, and that's how they generate drama. I'm getting a lot of grimacing from you, Katrine.
It's like, have you not watched prior seasons? Like, Jamie and Claire have quite a bit of conflict every so often. Now they're settled into their marriage, I think. But this is the beauty of this relationship as well. It's like, this is what Diane says. This is an examination of a marriage. It's not necessarily an examination of how two people get together. It's about how two people stay together, which I think is
exactly. Which I think most drama is about how most people are being torn apart. A lot of dramas a lot about, like, examine what's dysfunctional about relationships, whereas Outlander celebrates a very functional relationship, which in its core seems almost antithetical to drama, but a lot of people find the drama in that. And as you say, there is drama in that. And there's, I think a lot of people take a lot of thrill from seeing Jamie and Claire work out their problems in a very, maybe it's not idealistic way, but a very life-affirming way, a very love-affirming way.
Well, I think that's where a lot of their passion comes from. And I think, you know, as you were talking about, you know, that earlier scene, it's like, they are so physical with each other, but it's on a very equal footing. And I think that that is what also makes them so interesting to watch, is that they are both these volcanic personalities that when they come together, it's just like so explosive. in all the best ways. And it's, I don't know. I think their messiness and their imperfection is so like key to what's so interesting about them. But it's also, you know, I don't think we're striving to show people perfection.
I think a lot of people really admire or look towards their sex life. That the sex life between Jamie and Claire is, I think, is a lot of the reason people really idealize this couple. It's so passionate. In spite of the length of time they've spent together, they can find any reason to get it on. And a lot has been spoken about Outlander's handling of sex scenes and the way that it seems to satisfy what they say, that the female gaze, which I think is really cool and laudable, and they've called it revolutionary for TV. But I was wondering if I could ask this from a different angle ask it from what it's like as the actor portraying these scenes, because how they're perceived on screen may not be the same, have those same values of female empowerment, et cetera, when you're actually filming them. What's it like to be filming these sex scenes and when you're asked to get naked and shoot a sex scene on Outlander?
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, season one was such a learning curve. Primarily, I'd never done sex scenes before. I don't think Tobias had, Sam might have on something else before, but we were all sort of, you know, quite naive, I think, about it. And in the beginning as well, I was really trying to find my footing, as in where I could personally draw lines about what I was comfortable with and what I wasn't. And I think also it's not until you see yourself later, where, you know, you really realize what the impact of having scenes like that out there are. And, you know, it's always this sort of fine line, because you want to honor the character and you want to honor the scenes, but you want to protect yourself. And I think that that's always a really difficult line. And especially, you know, we started filming the show 7 years ago. I was a young, sprightly thing in my early 30s. And as you get older, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's a hard thing. But also I think when I was starting in my 30s, I was in a very comfortable place in my life and with my body and all of those things. And I look at some of the younger actresses coming onto the show and you worry, because we sort of set a precedent and you think, oh, you know, for young women in their 20s, do they feel as comfortable? Are they going to be under pressure to sort of show what we have shown? And I think it's always such a difficult, it's always such a difficult thing, because as an actor, you're not getting into this business to take your clothes off. You know, you're getting into this business to portray characters. And sometimes that's a necessity to say something about the character, but it becomes really difficult when it becomes expected. And then it almost feels like sometimes people expect certain things from you without taking into consideration that, you know, your family is out there and, you know, the local priest is watching the show or whatever it might be, and that this stuff lives forever. You know, so I definitely, yeah, it's, I have, I don't know, it's still something to this day that it's always a negotiation about what is necessary for the scene and what is expected.
I think you said something interesting there about things changing from like in a time period. And I'm thinking also that what's changed in that time period is that in 2017, we had the massive Me Too movement. And I'm wondering, has that in any way changed the way you approach a sex scene?
Not really on our show. I mean, for Sam and I, because I think, you know, we learned so much after the first season that I think we sort of put in protocols after that first season that sort of worked for us and worked for the writers, and we sort of continued that. I think, you know, what changed after that is I think a lot more characters came on the show that needed to also do sex scenes. And I think that that just gave a broader awareness to everyone. But I think everyone's just more aware now that it's not just this expectation that anything goes and that people have to be sensitive, which I think is so important. But I think it's also, I've noticed it a lot more on other sets when I've gone to sets that there's a different atmosphere since the sort of Me Too movement. I think in Scotland, we sort of live in a bubble. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong or anything, but, I think it's always been quite respectful with us. I don't know.
Yeah. I've said this before, but I remember that one of the things I received with dread when I signed the Outlander contract was, and here is your nudity clause. And I was like, oh geez, I've never signed one of these, and I'm not quite sure if I'm ready to. But I was always holding out. I was thinking, you know, any moment now they're going to write a sex scene for me. At some point it's going to happen. That's Outlander. And one of the first things that when people mention Outlander and sex scenes are kind of synonymous. And sure enough, it did get written in at one point. I think it was in season
four. You had a sex scene last season. Yes,
it was in season four. And I remember in an early draft, there was like naked bodies and lots of like things that made me kind of feel very uncomfortable. But also thinking like, man, I got to get to the gym. And I had that same body shame that you have, you know, as an actor. It's not, some of it's vanity, but also some of it's just like taking your clothes off on national television. I think it's very human to have that sense of like, I don't know if it's shame, but just embarrassment or privacy.
It is. Yeah. And it's such a weird thing because you're constantly, or at least I constantly am torn between these two things of, well, Claire would not be going to the gym, so I should not have a gym body. And she's now a woman in her 50s. So, you know, I should try and let that be the thing that sort of leads me. But then you have all of your own personal shit, right? You have your own personal shame and vanity and all of those things. And you try and leave those at the door. But also, you know that if you feel insecure, that's going to hamper your ability to lose yourself in a scene. So it's always this thing I'm constantly battling with between leaving my shit at the door and also giving myself, I guess, enough confidence to be able to walk into those scenes and not have to think about whether or not I have cellulite on my ass or, you know, my whatever these things are that kind of run through your head. And it's, you know, we're not unflawed people, and it's hard sometimes to also live up to the expectation of the fact that sometimes you're given very little warning of when you're going to shoot these scenes. And that's quite frustrating. Like sometimes these scenes can be thrown on you like within 2 days' notice. And, you know, as a woman, there are many things you have to consider. And it's, you know, sometimes biology and cycles, and I'm going to say it, like these things have a huge effect on your ability to sort of be free in these moments. And I think sometimes that's something that producers don't always consider. And
I'm more worried about my carb loading and, you know, my sugar intake. And I've never had to really think about that.
I mean, we're unpacking it, right, David? So I'm just, you know, putting it all out there.
Well, I don't know if you do know this, but maybe what needs to happen is you need to have a better relationship to the VFX department, okay? Because I have it on good authority from someone who's worked on some of these Marvel films that there is a certain budget that's put aside for certain actors to, you know, do some sort of cosmetic things when they're on screen. So if you have a multi-million dollar, say you set aside $1 million for a ex superhero to, you know, fix the hair there, facelift there, abs there, physique just so, then you don't even have to go to the gym. You don't have any of those worries about body shame and, that's what you have to do.
I just don't think we have the Marvel budget to take care of all of that.
There was enough worry on the last season where I came up to do a tiny little scene, and it was just me reciting the letter back to Murta's troops to say, no, you're going to surrender and you're going to do all this. And it was just me in my little hut pacing backwards and forwards, dictating this letter. And the night before... the morning before I got on the boat to then get the plane, because we were on the Isle of Wight at the time, my youngest, I went to go and pick her up. She didn't want me. And so poked me, bang, straight in the eye and burst the blood vessels on the eye. So much so, my eye looked like a bionic black sort of like pool ball, like a black eight ball, totally cut. And it was a horror. It was an absolute horror. So much so that people would literally kind of go, oh, is everything okay? And so when we got on set to do this particular scene, literally we had gangs of people come around going, what on earth is that? I've never seen anything quite like that. Are you okay? Is it bleeding now? Things like that. So they had to color that in. So they had the FX guys come in and spend whatever budget there was to color in my incredibly bloodshot eye, so I didn't look like some sort
that's
of.
That's where our whole budget went.
That's where the budget went.
Also CGI'd your mustache out because you refused to shave it off. Am I correct?
It's I'm very much like Samson when it comes to that. And if you take it away, you wouldn't do it to Selleck. You wouldn't do it to Reynolds.
You wouldn't do it to Henry Cavill, apparently.
Who's Reynolds?
Burt Reynolds.
Oh, yes, of course.
Smokey and the Bandit. Sorry. Not Ryan Reynolds.
I know.
Ryan Reynolds is... Imagine that, if you actually saw the real Ryan Reynolds and he had a big, full set, big beard, incredibly long eyebrows. Yeah, wow, that's impressive.
It's interesting that you have to hearken back to the 80s for your mustache references, Tim.
Well, most of them are now beards.
Selleck, Reynolds.
Yeah, Reynolds, Selleck, still very relevant. Apart from Reynolds, he's dead. But mainly now it's beards, you know, look like Zach Galifianakis, very famous sort of beard wearer from The Hangover.
Yeah, no, it's just an interesting.
Yeah.
He can't be that famous, Tim, if you have to explain where he's from.
Well, I was given a look like I'd said it wrong, which is very much a thing I do of saying things ever so slightly wrong.
No, I mean, you could be saying it right. I was always Galifianakis, but...
Well, he doesn't answer that. One thing with him is he won't answer. If you say his name slightly wrong and you're on the phone, he'll just say, I don't know who that is. You know, one of those kind of, no, you know who I mean. You know who I mean. Galifianakis. That's somebody else. God, petty.
Petty.
I had another question just before we wrap things up. Outlander has become a huge part of your life. You've received widespread acclaim for your performance. You've broken into mainstream Hollywood with films like Ford versus Ferrari. But moving forward, what else do you hope to get out of Outlander? You're now a producer. You've mentioned maybe directing. What sustains you as a creative person coming back to the same show in the same role year after year for 6 years? I mean, the show chronicles this enduring love between Jamie and Claire. My question is, what fuels your enduring love for the show?
Aw, so many things. You know, it is, it's definitely changed over the years for me. And I think that was part of the main reason that I was so eager to become a producer. I mean, I think in many ways, you know, seasons one and two, I was just on set all the time. And, you know, season three, the show started to open up a lot more and it was no longer all told through Claire's perspective. So sort of since season three, I've actually had less to do. And I think to be able to keep growing in this show, it felt like I needed to find sort of another outlet and start kind of, you know, expanding or just, you know, finding new things to learn. And I think that that's what becoming a producer has been about. And it's been a very interesting learning curve. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a limit to our involvement and a limit to our influence because there's already such a strong team of producers already there. But definitely going forward, I mean, I have made no secret of the fact that I would love to direct. I think that this would be the perfect opportunity for me since I know the show so well. I know the crew so well. I think I have absorbed a lot of information watching the countless directors that we've had on the show. And it's just something I think I would love to do. And, you know, we'll see. that's not something that's just sort of given out willy-nilly, but I'm chipping away at the powers that be with the hope that one day they'll let me. So we'll see. And then you'll all regret it.
And then when it's all in black and white and all shot on a fisheye lens. Yes, that'll be it. Fabulous. Well, Kat, thank you so much for your time and your insights into Outlanderdom. Hopefully you weren't pecked to death by gulls as the turtle from our said intro, which is always good. We are not the gulls. It was a metaphorical gull. But thank you.
I missed that. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
But thank you for bringing back around to that.
People want to know what was going on with that. And
I thought you were the turtle, but now that I know that I was the turtle this entire time.
We're all the turtles, Kat. We're all the turtles.
Is this like a Terry Pratchett turtle? I don't know. Is it?
It's like a Terry Gilliam sort of turtle.
Oh, okay.
So it doesn't carry the weight. It doesn't carry like another a world on its back.
Well, we unpacked the big stuff with you, Kat, and we went through all kinds of weird metaphors. So thank you for bearing with us.
Well, it's my absolute pleasure and so lovely to see you both.
Hello and welcome to Listener Questions. Tim, we have a great one here today. It's from Cheryl. Cheryl says, "Hi, David and Tim. I really enjoy your podcast, especially the episode with Richard Rankin and the discussions about food. My husband has a strange habit of urinating in the tea he serves guests at our home. He says it gives him a kick. Though I was shocked at first, I have started enjoying it too. In fact, I do the same when making tea for our guests. I have heard that drinking urine is not harmful. Is it safe to continue doing this? Thanks very much, Cheryl." Well, wow. Cheryl. Wow. That is... what do you got to say to that, Tim?
Well, I'm not coming around your house. That's for darn sure. Certainly not going to accept any hot beverage or lukewarm, more to the point. I'm not going to certainly accept a lukewarm beverage from you. I believe it's not harmful to drink urine. I do think, though, it's not something that should be continued. It sounds like an offence. It sounds quite aggressive thing to do. What have these people done to you? Is the first question. Why would you do such a thing? Is this just the tip of the iceberg? Have indeed you in fact defecated in a brownie or some sort of dirty protest with a Sunday lunch? I just don't know. It honestly, it puts me on edge, and I'm quite concerned about those around you. It's quite full on. I think it's given me an instant headache, David, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I certainly hope you don't own a restaurant or anything like that. I've never really understood how to make tea, and I'm glad we have you as an authority here, Tim, to tell us how tea should be made, because up until this point, I didn't know that you didn't put urine into tea. It's why I never drank it. But thank you. Yeah. An Englishman here has told us how you make tea. Don't put urine in it.
Don't put urine in it. No.
Not safe. I think we've answered that categorically here. And thank you for that question, Cheryl.
Yeah. Urine should only be used, for when you're tanning your own leather in your house. And every Englishman knows how to do that. I don't need to tell anybody here. Thank you for listening to Outcasts.
Please remember to rate, subscribe, and leave a review, as it all helps.
Follow us on our Instagram page at outcast.podcast for all the latest updates.
Or you can send us an email at outcastspodcastshow@gmail.com.
Every week, we shall select a question from one of our listeners to answer on the show.
The theme music is composed by Kieran Ledwidge. All views and opinions expressed on the show are our own and have no affiliation with the series of books written by Diana Gabaldon or the Sony Stars television show Outlander.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast. Although I did have a ham sandwich earlier, so.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.